Richard Gilman, the drama and literary critic, died over the weekend. He had been ill for several years after being diagnosed with terminal lung cancer in 1997. He was 83. Gilman grew up in New York and became a drama critic for Commonweal in the 50s and for Newsweek in the mid-60s. He was a professor at the Yale University School of Drama for 31 years. His students included the playwrights Christopher Durang and Wendy Wasserstein. Gilman favored the avant-garde and could be dismissive of narrative mainstream theater. Robert Brustein, who hired him at Yale, said Gilman's writing was a wake-up call for American theater and, quote, an important corrective to a theater that did not have much in the way of a brain, only a feverish set of nerves and spasms masking a deep sentimentality. Gilman wrote several books, including The Making of Modern Drama and Chekhov's Plays. I spoke with him in 1987, after the publication of his memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery.
You were born into Judaism. When you became religious, how come you didn't become a religious Jew?
Well, as I say in the book, I had a perfunctory Jewish upbringing. You know, I went to Hebrew school and I was bar mitzvahed and went to synagogue on the holy days. My mother and father were, I would say, perfunctory nominal Jews. My grandparents were quite religious. But I didn't grow up in a religious home at all, and I never really learned anything about Judaism as a religion. Essentially, what it was a tribal reality, and I never was interested in it as a religious thing, and it slipped away from me very quickly once I was bar mitzvah and reached 14, 15, at which point I declared myself a very adamant atheist, which was partly a political stance, you know, at the time. But for the next 10 years or so, I investigated passionately every kind of system of belief. I was looking for something.
What did you find in Catholicism that you didn't find in other places?
Well, I found truth, what I considered to be truth. There is a very strange, well, not so strange, something has happened in questions of intellect and questions of value, probably for the last couple of hundred years, which is that the truth of a proposition or of an idea isn't the crucial thing. The relevance of it is. And I was convinced through a rather lengthy and arduous process of thought that Catholic claims to be the repository of truth in the very basic sense were justified. I joined the church essentially not for sentimental reasons, certainly not for emotional reasons, essentially for on the basis of the fact that once I saw something as true, it seemed to me that I had to act on it.
During the first part of your stay in the church as a converted Catholic, you were feeling you were getting a lot from it. When you were getting the most from it,
yes.
What was it you were getting?
Well, I was getting a sense of priorities. I was getting a sense of being, well, I described it as being carried by updrafts of grace. Of being sustained by a reality beyond myself, greater than myself, you know, all those kinds of things. I felt that my will was supported. I could will effectively. I could act the way I thought I should act. It's the only period of my life, and this lasted several years, in which I felt that my whole being, my psychic, my intellectual, my emotional selves were cohesive and moving together, and that didn't last, but it was there for a while.
You felt that integrated, but were you able to tell your parents that you converted?
I never told my parents, and I explain again in the book why. My parents were not Orthodox Jews. They were not very religious Jews, but they were very psychologically Jewish. And I didn't have a good relation with my father, but apart from that, I felt that there was no point in my telling them. They would not have understood. They would have felt offended. They would have felt affronted. They would have just about exploded or fainted or something, and I felt that there was not much point in telling them. I didn't believe then, and I don't believe now, in the primary virtue of what that fashionable word, sincerity. We should be sincere, you know. Sincerity hides a lot of spiritual pride. It hides a lot of arrogance and so on. I saw no reason for hurting them, and I saw no gain or value in that kind of sincerity in telling them. They suspected. They knew, especially when I started writing for a Catholic magazine called Jubilee, and then later Commonwealth.
A clue.
Yeah, they must have had some. I told them that these magazines did employ some non-Catholic writers, but I think they were so happy that I finally had a job, because I had not had a job. I was drifting through my 20s as what I used to call an intellectual bum or hobo. And so they were so pleased that I finally had a job that I think they would have swallowed anything. But in any case, I didn't tell them.
We're listening back to a 1987 interview with the drama and literary critic Richard Gilman. He died over the weekend at the age of 83. I spoke with him after the publication of his memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery. He converted from Judaism to Catholicism, but came to be frustrated by the church's view of sex.
I had trouble always reconciling the sexual aspects, well, the aspects of what are gathered under the rubric, the title lust, sins of the flesh, you know, lust. I think that obviously sexual sins are for many Catholics and much of the church as an institution, and for many religions, the most serious, the prime sin. And I don't think so. I've never thought so. I think that sexual sins can, for example, formal sexual sins, sins of lust, can have in them love, they can have in them generosity, they can have in them compassion and a sense of humanity, a sense of mortality and so on. In other words, they can have virtues in them that other sins like gluttony or avarice or cruelty, you know, do not have. And the church's emphasis, which is what I encountered, I think it has changed, I would imagine, certainly in the United States, changed for the better. It's not nearly as monolithic as it once was. The greatest trouble I had was to deal with what I thought of as the inflexibility, the abstract condemnation of certain acts, which I felt needed to be seen in a more supple, a more complex way. In a more compassionate way.
We keep quoting St. Augustine as saying, God, send me chastity, but not yet.
Yes.
But I get the feeling that in your own life, you didn't want to have to totally sacrifice the flesh in order to find spirituality.
Exactly. I thought I should, in a way, not sacrifice it completely, but for example, I was married much of that time, and I had problems with my wife. I had, on an occasion, I would go outside marriage and, you know, in other words, commit what was called technically adultery. I felt that my particular sexuality would be even more difficult for the church to accommodate. I remember thinking of Jesus sitting up on his throne in heaven and rolling his eyes in shock and horror at my particular fantasies, which, of course, is an absurd notion. But as I said before, I think no matter what my sexuality was, it would have come into conflict with the church. And that's the kind of response I've gotten from a lot of people who've written me, you know, about the book, that they experienced much of the same thing.
Well, I think for a lot of people who are religious or slightly religious, the conflict comes up between sexuality and religion, mm-hmm. or between some other belief or passion that they have in religion. And the question becomes, do you stay and fight off your impulses, or do you accept your impulses and leave the religious institution?
Yes, of course, that's the question. There was another aspect of my quarrel or battle with the church, and that was what I do call my ambition or my ambitiousness. When I came in the church, I felt a great relief from the burden of selfness, you know, burden of ambition, the burden of competitiveness, a feeling that I want to make a place for myself in the world. I was very ambitious, and I had a for quite a time I was very content to sort of labor anonymously, not worry about making a name for myself. And then gradually, as I got into my 30s, and I had literary ambitions and had them, which I'd squelched, which I'd simply suppressed in myself. And I know it was a kind of foolish dichotomy that I or opposition that I erected there. I was taking the admonition to be humble and, you know, and to efface myself quite literally. And even though I consciously knew and was told by people I knew at the time that there was nothing irreligious or sinful in developing my talents, you know, and gaining a reputation, I felt guilty over that. And finally, the ambition, the suppressed literary desires broke through, and I began to feel that this humility that I'd had before was pretty false.
What do you even talk about? A self-aggrandizing kind of humility.
Yeah. Now, you see, I still think this is something that touches on a great many things. You pointed out at the beginning of the book, you quoted the idea that I do not have any real belief today. I still have some. I have a faint, more than faint, it's there. Some kind of, for example, I'm not an atheist. I believe in God. I don't know how or what. But one thing that I got from the church, from the essence of the church, the best part of the church, was a sense of something to combat the fierce, cannibalistic almost, you know, competitiveness of our time, which is gaining all the time, the aggression, the greed, the putting of the self first, which we phenomena we see all around us, you know, and it seems to grow all the time. I remember feeling that only through this kind of principle of at least partial self-effacement or generosity, a sense of giving to others, could you combat that, what seemed to be the tide of the times, you know, the tremendous individualism, the dog-eat-dog, the man is a wolf to man, and all of that, which I felt then and see even more strongly now.
So you believe in God in a kind of, but that's where the mystery comes in. You're
yes.
not part of an organized religion
no.
right now.
No, I don't go to church. I don't know if I ever will go back. I didn't write the book in order to go back. You know, and yet I find stirrings of various kinds.
I want to ask you one mm-hmm. last thing. You almost apologize to your readers at the end of your memoir for giving them nothing definitive, no calls to order, no models for behavior, no moral resting place. But it seems to me that finally that's what your experience is about. It's about continually questing for some kind of answers to big questions, but not finding pat answers.
Right. Well, I think that came... I had the sense that and perhaps I was silly to worry about this, but I have a feeling that in books of this kind, this, the broad genre, people are looking for some kind of answer, and of course they get very cheap ones, you know, from lots of people. Some kind of thing, now I'm this, and now I'm that, and by implication, this is what you should be, and this is what you might do, and so forth. I came out with no conclusion. I am still, as you know, as I said, peddling in midair. I don't, I have no answers. And it's interesting that a number of letters that I've gotten from people have told me that that's fine, it's all right, they didn't want me to, you know, that it would have been false if I'd come out with some denouement, you know, some final conclusion and saying, this is it, this is the truth. I don't know.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your experiences with us today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Theater and literary critic Richard Gilman recorded in 1987 after the publication of his memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery. He died over the weekend at the age of 83.